Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello, hello, and welcome to this episode 148 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. Today we've got something a little special. We have our first returning guest, and that is none other than Mr. Heath Kane. He first appeared when he was around 18 months into his journey as being an artist, and that was way back in October 2018. It was recorded on a bench in Hoxton Square, and we spoke for hours, so much so that it went out as a double episode. Although you'll be glad to hear that this episode has been reined in and it's less than an hour. And as you'll hear in this episode, although Heath's work has changed considerably in that time, the narrative that runs through every project is still the same and just as strong, if not stronger. And I was going to say a lot has happened in Heath's world in the last 5.5 years, but since October 2018, I think so much in all of our lives has changed. But yeah, it was great to have him back. And I did only ask him just a couple of days ago because last week I was in Barcelona. I got speaking to another artist and Heath Kane came up in that conversation. We was talking about my podcast and he said you should have Heath back on again. So I got home, got in touch with Heath, and well, here we are. So please, come with me as I spoke once again to Heath Kane.
Oh, there it is.
Hello, mate. How are you?
Yeah, good, buddy. Yeah, I'm really good.
I had a look last night, Heath. Yeah. It was October the 8th, 18, when the first podcast, well, when our podcast came out.
Yeah.
We spoke for so long, I cut it into two, didn't I? It was episode 9, and this one will probably be 248.
Wow.
That's mad, isn't it?
It really is. I was in the first dozen, maybe about that.
When we spoke, you had been making Richard and Batman for about 18 months.
Yeah.
It was about 18 months in, so that's where your journey was at that time.
Yeah.
And you was just on about creating the paintings that you've got behind you. The noblemen, Mexican wrestling mask.
Been and gone.
that phase is long gone.
So, well, where do you want to pick up?
So, what have you been doing since?
What have I been doing since? God, I mean, where do you start with that?
Well, you had, what was that series called?
That behind me, there were Portrait of Heroes. So they were done at the time of sort of around Brexit, and the purpose of them was just to sort of echo this sort of, I guess, identity issue, where, you know, back then when Brexit was sort of coming about, you know, there was very much this sort of echo or call to arms around making things go back to the way they were, you know, as if they were great once upon a time. And, you know, the same rhetoric was sort of being called from over the pond in America with Donald Dickwad. And, you know, it's a really dangerous rhetoric to have when you start sort of calling on this idea of going back to something, because, you know, we never become a progressive society if you become, you know, doing the opposite, you know, this idea of becoming regressive. and going back to something. You know, my point was, by doing these, which were all sort of done from the Romantic period, which I thought was kind of symbolic, because that was when, you know, the Australia was colonized. You have Jane Austen, you had all these sort of great moments of British sort of history, but actually they weren't. And that's what I think people sort of forget. You know, you get fooled into this sort of sense of that it was a romantic time, but, you know, if I look out my window right now, I'm looking at buildings that were made in the 17th century, and you've got to remember, they were throwing piss and shit out the windows.
exactly.
There's hardly anything romantic about the romantic period.
It's all right for those throwing the shit. It's not any good for those beneath it, is it?
Well, but even in that time, you know, one in three people died of smallpox and cholera and all these things. So I did a lot of these portraits, you couldn't help but think that those who they love, you know, think about a family. You were talking about your son there earlier, which is heartbreaking, you know. But you could imagine if your family unit, you know, one in three people died. I mean, and then you go off and get this amazing sort of portraiture, like, you know, the world is fantastic. And that was kind of what they sort of led into, was this idea that if you know anything about Lucha Libre, there's this sort of ethos that when you put a mask on, that you become imbued with power and strength, and when you take it off, you become ordinary. And as you probably know, when we first met, I've always been fascinated by masks. I think they're just integral with my work. I mean, we all have a mask. At the time when I was, or when we first probably met, you know, I was still full-time doing, running a branding agency. Yes. And then on the side, I was just doing this for kicks as an outlet. Obviously, you know, nowadays, if you talk about what's happened over probably the last, well, since 2018, I've gone full-time into art. So I'm now a full-time delinquent. And
that's quite a funny thing, Heath, because at the time I put that question to you. Do you think there would come a time when you would stop your branding agency and be a full-time artist? And you couldn't see that happening.
Yeah.
And what was it that done that? Was it the lockdowns that put a stop to that? And
Bizarrely, that's when I made the decision, because I just thought, I don't have to answer to anyone. You know, I've got this pedestal where I can just do and stir the pot, because my work's been political of nature, and sort of, I guess in a way it sort of works in a kind of like social activism way, where I pick up on topics which I want people to start questioning, because, you know, like Brexit, I was frustrated by what I still think is just the lack of information that people made judgment on, you know, that it's quite clear that everyone was lied to. You know, it's easy to put your hand up and say, I fucking told you so. But, you know, it's a right shit show. And but you can see it reverberating, you know, now. I mean, the fact that Trump is still coming back onto the circuit and, you know, highly likely to gain power again is fucking frightening. You just sort of wonder what kind of level of stupidity are people fucking falling for?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm either clearly missing something, but I don't think I am. I think, you know, he's a dangerous person and he should be put in jail. But, you know, here we are and we've got people think he's a messiah. So,
but that's why people are voting for Trump, because they see him as a real person.
Well, I guess this is why lots of children have fear of clowns, don't they? So
exactly.
it's the ones that have turned into being these psychopaths like it. So that's what we've had now for the last 10 years.
So how did you feel there, Heath, making that decision? I know that it was an easier decision to make because the world had stopped or paused for a moment.
Yeah.
I'm sure that the wage you was on at the time, I'm aware, was a, you know, a good wage. And
yeah, well, that was it. You must have thought, well, it was hard to turn it down.
That's going to go, yeah.
I mean, I guess that's the, you know, you often sort of see this as the reality of living a comfortable lifestyle and taking sort of luxury holidays. And then you sort of fall into this sort of sense of it's great being an artist, but then you quickly realize there's the paradox of, you know, being a starving artist is it's for the reason that it's a hard bloody living to make.
So how are your kids getting on in the workhouse at the moment?
Yeah, well, this is the tactic. You've got to have children to prop you up. Yeah, exactly. So, do you know what? It's interesting because I think it's worth talking about COVID, only because I think it was a really fascinating time. I mean, you probably remember that everyone came up to that sort of cusp. I had just moved all this screen printing equipment over to a warehouse just where I am now. And it was quite fortunate I had done that because it just allowed me to, when, you know, lockdown happened, you know, I could just basically lock myself away.
Lose yourself, yeah.
And then just print. And I often look back at it and think, God, do you remember that where people were trying to create these campaigns to support an artist, you know, and there was this idea of almost like a Ponzi scheme where everyone had to buy from each other in order to prop themselves up. And yet the reality was quite different. You know, I know very few artists who didn't make an absolute killing during COVID, because it was the perfect storm. You know, so you got everyone locked at home, looking at blank walls, going fucking crazy with disposable income because they couldn't go out and drink and go to the pub and go, they didn't have to go into work. They didn't have to spend all these things. And they've got all this sort of money burning in their pocket. And so, you know, at that time, unbeknownst, like most people, that this was going to happen, I decided this was the year I was going to go full time as an artist. And then like everyone, just went, oh, fuck, you know, thinking, you know, I was just going to be Gilligan on Gilligan's Island, just be blown away. And, you know, it really kind of set me up because everything just went in turbo mode. I mean, I was at the time doing print runs, which I just sit in this warehouse knocking out, and I was selling them in 90 seconds. And I was going for long runs at the time. And I just remember hearing this little ping, 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 ping in as I was running. And then I'd look on my phone about a minute later and the whole entire collection sold out. Just then carry on running with a smile on my face. So
straight back to the studio.
Well, and then that was
to
it.
Print
and then
some
it was,
more.
But, you know, tell me any artist who's doing that situation at the moment. We're in a complete sort of reverse. I think it's, you know, cost of living and, you know, everything that's sort of fallen off the back of Ukraine. And it's interesting, all these events happen without any sort of decision or any kind of involvement of people. And I think that's kind of what keeps prompting me to get, you know, use my voice and art just to sort of show how dissatisfied I am, because I just feel like we've got no say in the matter. You know, all this thing with energy prices, everything are all these strange outcomes, which, you know, are in the hands of the few. And I think, you know, it's nice using art as a voice to be able to say, fuck you, I'm not part of this, you know, or I don't want to be part of it. So that's, I don't think, you know, from the moment when I first met you, despite the fact that I was in a comfortable sort of position and probably had money in my pocket, to today where I'm sort of thinking, shit, where's my next paycheck coming from? You know, I don't think anything's changed in terms of my outlook on and my approach to art. I think the only thing I've found maybe is I'm in probably more debt because I've now started a gallery keep wondering, why do I keep spending money on framing? Because it just costs a fortune, only to wait sort of 6 months for things to sort of sell.
Yeah.
But then I sort of say that facetiously, I actually really enjoy having the gallery. But, you know, it's just, I think it's a really interesting time. But I think what, you know, the other interval for me was where I guess I had, like many artists who've done pretty well for themselves, of having this sort of icon, sort of cash cow. So, you know, for me, it was very much Rich Enough to Be Batman. I could just print them to the day's end, you know.
Well, that's what I said to you when we first met. And if I put a parallel with Real Acne Dave, with his maps, when, yeah. And the same, and you had a similar sort of story. Dave also being, well, Dave being
the
in
same
advertising.
Time as I did, yeah.
Exactly. And I spoke to you both round about the same time, and you were both doing art as a sideline, if you like, or
yep.
You know, just something to vent out your creativity. Oh yeah, and I said to Dave as well, just like with his Wish You Were Here maps,
yeah.
And you're Rich Enough to Be Batman, they will last you until the day you take your last breath, because they are just perfect little things that resonate with everyone, every age, every generation, from every background.
Well, I kind of thought that, but equally, I didn't ever want to be someone who was just known for that one thing. So if you've sort of seen, I'm probably one of those few artists who will, even though it's kind of like a meal ticket, I'll go off and just explore other things.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've done probably in that time about 8 different collections, which are variantly different. I mean, the fact that I painted those to screen print Rich Enough to Be Batman, to doing the series, which is kind of haunting me now, around Master mm-hmm. Fear, which was this on a whim, where I did a sort of this idea that Trump would come in as a potential elective for president. And then it turns out that he did get voted in. And then I did, got commissioned by Wired Magazine to do the cover of their magazine, where I did a triptych with Trump, Putin, and Kim Jong-un, you know, and pretty much the sort of same goes with Rich Enough to Be Batman. I very much thought they were going to be ephemeral, that I just thought they were very much sort of, you know, there in the zeitgeist, that I was just making a comment on. But obviously with Rich Enough to Be Batman, the idea being that it was really about, wouldn't it be nice if more people rich enough to be Batman used their wealth to do good? I mean, we've seen an enormous increase, you know, even back when I was doing it. I mean, the context when I was first did it is that I was in branding, working for luxury goods, and I was targeting billionaires, and I was just sort of seeing the kind of how they would squander money. You know, you just sort of think, this is not how I would spend 50 million if I had 50 million. And then when you sort of see that 50 million is a drop in the ocean to what, you know, the sort of billionaires are now making. So all those were sort of contextual, but I guess what frustrates me is these problems haven't gone away. You know, the Rich Enough to Be Batman is even bigger issue now, because, you know, there's now a trajectory that, you know, you've got the three richest men who have approximately 200 or 300 billion in their back pocket, which I still staggers me that, you know, no one's questioning. Because if you think about it, and this is what keeps getting me, or keeps me up at night, is, you know, 1 billion, like 1 billion is an extraordinary amount of money. You know, in you know, mathematical terms, it's 1,000 times a million, right? But in practical terms, it's the same of making £1 million salary for 1,000 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Just stop and think about that for a second. No one can obviously live 1,000 years to make a first billion. So that's assuming that you live 1,000 years on £1 million salary, which no one makes. And you don't spend a penny to make a billion, and they've got 200 billion. That's the equivalent of, you know, making a £1 million salary from the Mesopotamian era or before, right? It's just, you know, in fact, it's probably going back to a Neanderthal and getting £1 million salary. I mean, it's just ludicrous.
Especially when you look at how much it would cost in real terms, not to cure, but to ease world starvation.
Oh, yeah.
It's a drop in the ocean to them. And
well, it's like 20 billion. They
exactly.
crunched the numbers and they said...
Collectively, it could be nothing to them.
Yeah. I mean, there was that incident where I think it was the World Health Organization presented Elon Musk with this sort of opportunity to solve world hunger. And he kind of, you know, sort of scoffed at it. And he said, it's not possible. And they said, in fact, he kind of goaded them to say, if you can prove it, then I'll do it. And then he crunched the numbers and showed that with 20 billion or 25 billion, that they could solve world hunger. And instead of actually taking plight on this, he went off and bought Twitter a week later for 40 billion, the fucking donkey. So
mental, isn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, so nothing's changed. I'm still a bitter old man. I've just got bitterer, I guess, and older.
Well, speaking of rich enough to be Batman, on its literal visual sense, the Queen, when she passed, was there any fluctuation in your sales for her? Did they decline or go up, or was it just pretty much the same?
And before she died, around about the time of her jubilee, I think it was, I kind of decided I was just going to draw a line under it and just finish it, despite the fact that it was, you know, kind of a cash cow for me. And I just felt like, you know, I could, there's only so much you can kind of beat a horse. I just felt it was time to kind of push myself to do something more interesting. So I had that very much in mind to sort of stop doing it. And in fact, I think I even made an announcement before she died that I was going to do it. Okay. And then, yeah, I saw a spike of people going out and buying on a death, which always kind of bewilders me, because I saw the same happen when I did the series In Brands We Trust with Barbie, when the Barbie movie came out. And I saw the same with Napoleon that I did for Portrait of Heroes when Ridley Scott's Napoleon film came out. But obviously with the Queen, it sort of became more of a kind of call to arms that, you know, quick, I better buy something. And I just thought, why?
Yeah, yeah.
But having said that, I kept getting people begging for me to sell again. So I have re-released 3 editions, which are open editions. So I just don't have the worry of having to think about a new color edition. I just thought, I know these work, and I know they kind of work across the spectrum with people's choices. So I've just done it. And so that is very much kind of parked, but, you know, still accessible. I do like the idea of being able to provide art, because there's nothing worse. I'm sure you agree. Like you come across an artist and you think, shit, you know, I love that. And then you find out that was a couple of years ago and they've stopped selling ever since. But you think like, oh, I really would love to get that. So that's part reason why I kind of opened it back up again. But now I'm working on a new collection with Our Types, which, as you know, is Ben Ines and Juan and crew. And, it's a complete sort of, I mean, I think it very much fits onto my style is very much the signature on thinking. Like I always have a kind of a political sort of motivation. And I think the style is always held by this idea of making something that's attractive, that you're drawn to, which is a sort of a graphic design kind of tendency, you know, pull someone in by using colors and whatnot to attract them. And then you drop the message.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Whereas normally where graphic design is very much about, you know, pulling people into consumerism, mine's very much about pulling people into this sort of darkness of anti-capitalism. And so these pieces that I'm doing now, which I can swivel so you can see,
I've seen flowers. Those look great. Just for people listening, could you just explain what it is you just showed me and the work that you are creating?
Yeah, so they're pictures of balloon flowers put into pots. And I think the idea, kind of like Rich Enough to Be Batman, is that you're naturally drawn to it because you just sort of see the humor in it. You just sort of see something unexpected. But I guess with balloon flowers, you're sort of... You don't kind of question it. And the collection's called Oblivious because, you know, in this day and age where we're sort of become enlightened to the fact of climate change and, you know, the sort of environmental sort of and eco damage that we're doing, you know, I think we are oblivious to everything that's going on. So, you know, my point about them was, We technically should be, you know, kind of repelled by them, but we're drawn to them because we naturally think, oh, that's cute, I like those. And yet the idea should be like, oh, that's disgusting, because it's, despite the fact that they're latex, and in fact, I should caveat that the people who made the balloons for me, you know, stressed that they were sustainably farmed using rubber that's tapped and this and that and the other. I think it's a metaphor for the fact that, you know, we're replacing, you know, natural life, i.e. flowers, with synthetic. And we don't kind of see that. We just sort of go, oh, I really like that because it's shiny and it's bright and it's happy. And, you know, it's the same thing goes with, we'll go out and buy a brand new car, despite the fact that we know that it's emitting carbon to the atmosphere and causing, or we'll get on a plane and go somewhere warm, despite the fact we know that's contributing to global warming. Yeah. So there's all this thing that it's kind of, I guess in a way, it's the sort of cynical view to say we're fucked, that, you know, we'll always be in this position that we're oblivious to the obvious, that whatever we decide to do is going to be harmful.
Yeah.
And because we're always going to be attracted to shiny, bright, happy things.
Of course.
Because we're emotional creatures.
We're all magpies.
Ultimately, we're all going to die in a very, you know, blazing inferno because we just wanted to get the last bit of sun ray, or, you know.
Exactly that. So what is the collaboration between you and Ben, or Einsteins?
Our types. So they approached me a while ago. We did they reached out I think it was about 2 years ago, and they were doing a show around skateboard decks, and I just threw in kind of a strange one with Mao on it, I think they just kind of liked the fact that I was coming from a different direction and asked and just said, you know, love to do a collab with you guys or with me. And we've just sort of stayed in touch. And I had some ideas. I was working on a collection, which I'm still in the back of my mind want to get off the ground, called Happy Propaganda. And I just couldn't kind of nail it. And I sort of proposed some ideas, which I thought might work at the time, but I retracted them at the sort of 11th hour. And then this came about last year. It was just like a sideline project. So last year I kind of took almost a year out just to focus on new projects. So I did very little, or released very little last year, but I kind of was working on lots of things, and out of it come probably about two or three projects, and one of which was this with the balloon flowers, which I kind of find really fun and endearing. So yeah, we just sort of said, I've got this idea, and I guess because each piece is graffitied and with spray paint, so no two, even though the way I've printed them is full color, so CMYK. I have made each one completely unique, and so each piece has sort of spray paint with these sort of dripping spray paint pieces, and it's really to sort of represent this idea that we're vandalizing our own environment. But you know, they just again add to the coolness of them. People just go, oh, I like those. But again, you know, it's this idea of trying to drop a little bit of acid in the water and make people realize that it's not as clean as they sort of expect it to be. So yeah, we've just only launched those in April. I did 58, so they're 58 original pieces. I mean, it was a lot of work to produce, but it was a lot of fun to do as well, because when you sort of see all of them kind of standing next to each other, you just sort of see all these nuances and variations, which I deliberately tried to instill into all of them. So yeah, it was kind of a really nice, endearing project, and I think as well, it kind of is sort of shows something that I've been looking to do for a long time with my art, which is this idea of, learning the trade of screen print. I like the paintedly sort of thing that I did with Portrait of Heroes, and I kind of want to go back to that. But the problem, I guess, is this sort of expediency of producing art, or at least, when you produce something that size, it takes weeks, months to do. And, I realized in order to sort of stay in business and keep kind of, the wolves at bay is having some way of, producing art that's accessible. That's why screen printing is a really nice sort of thing. But what I've tried to do is I guess manufacture this idea of, rather than buying a clone of a clone of a clone, despite the fact that screen printing always creates like some little nuance that will make each piece unique, I really wanted to make that part really obvious and make it feel like, I own something truly original. So that's kind of what I think these pieces represent, is that you are buying an original piece, but you're buying it for £250 as opposed to 2,000 or, £20,000 to get an original piece. So,
Well, I remember coming round to your home and you had one of those on the floor that you was working on.
yeah.
And you could see that it was just a big canvas that had just been had hours and hours of work on. And although it was a great finished image, you could see the hours that went into it, which
Oh, yeah.
isn't which every painter would be screaming at the moment. But when you are a screen printer and you're used to sort of literally pulling one
Yeah.
color a couple of times or several times, and then that's the piece complete. Your practice has just taken on so many more hours.
Yeah, and I think people forget, because I've been doing screen printing classes, and it kind of really shows people and gives them respect for screen printing as an art, because whilst you do use a squeegee and you're pulling ink through the screen, it's no different to holding a paintbrush in your hand. Because with these particular pieces, what I've sort of I guess proven is that the pressure that you give onto it, gives each one are variantly different, and you could literally hold two of them together, and you can see just by applying a bit more pressure or pushing in a certain way or tilting things, it just leads to a completely different outcome. So yeah, I've really kind of enjoyed it as an art form now. And as I say, I'm just kind of constantly exploring more into the ways of how do you really turn sort of screen printing into more of a sort of paintedly kind of finish. And that's just where I think these are starting to prove. So yeah, the next things that I'm going to be doing, I think, are very much going in this line and going further away from my original sort of roots of just doing big blocks sort of screen print.
Yeah, nice. Could we talk about Background Bob?
Yep.
For anyone that doesn't know, well, I'll let you explain. You know Background Bob better than I do. You was sort of a key figure to Background Bob and his family when they started their journey.
Yeah, I think that's got, I'd still wonder how that came about. I think it was Nathan, who was very much integral in...
Who is Background Bob's dad.
That's correct, yeah. And so Noah was Background Bob. He reached out to me via Instagram and said that he was doing this charity event and if I'd like to get involved. And at the time, I just immediately said yes. I mean, I've been involved in probably about 20 or 30 charities at any given time throughout the year. But nonetheless, I think I must admit, at the time, I just thought it was really endearing. It was genuine. And I said yes. And he's not a million miles from me. He's the family's over by Colchester way, and I'm up by Saffron Walden near Cambridge. So, I think the fact that I sort of jumped on board, Nathan, Noah, had sort of came around and sort of met up, and we just instantly kind of got on. And I think just could sort of see what, it was just genuinely interesting what they were doing, but it was heartfelt and it really just changed, so many people.
And Noah was living with several quite major life-altering conditions, wasn't he?
Yes. I think, what they achieved together was, will be once in a lifetime. They really did just transform everybody. I mean, I think it's still kind of just really staggering to me how much they achieved. I mean, and who they pulled in. I mean,
yeah, it was great.
There, right? In the end, the fact that they had in just a star-studded cast. I mean, obviously my involvement was dwarfed by the sort of Ed Sheerans and Graham Perrys, and you just thought, fucking hell, they've gone a long way. Like, I literally was left on the wayside. But I know that wasn't the case by any means, because I think that was it. They were just so overthralled about everybody's involvement. But I think that was it. It was just this perpetual thing. And, we had the heart-struck moment. Nathan wrote to me Noah was in hospital a day before he passed away. And he wrote to me saying, I think this is the end. And I went, I genuinely felt like, no, it can't be. But obviously they knew. It was a real stab to the heart to find out that he passed away. I mean, I think, the world was lost a great character, and it certainly just left a big hole in sort of art as a result, because it just brought out so much goodness.
Well, I'm sure that there will be a legacy coming on behind, because you can't have an art world without that big smile of Noah's featuring somewhere, can you?
No, and I've started to see there's this sort of perpetual movement now of be more like Bob.
Yeah, exactly.
Hashtag, yeah. Or be more Bob. And, I think his legacy will live on. I mean, as I say, Nathan is a character. He's just got this amazing energy to him. So I know that they're thinking about doing various things, and I'm sure kind of like so many people. Like I grew up in surfing. There was the legend of Eddie Aikau. I think he'll be sort of, Eddie Aikau of the art world. He will just be this sort of legend that everyone will still work towards and want to be like.
Brilliant. And Heath Kane, what has he got in store? What's coming up next for Heath?
I think this year's roadmap is very much just exploring what I'm doing. I mean, I'm always like this constant explorer looking for new things to do. As I say, I'm very much don't want to be sort of locked into just doing one thing. And last year, as I mentioned, I took a year out just to focus on doing, my own projects. And, whilst I think the next 6 months will very much be based around this Oblivious collection, I'm already starting to work on things that, I might more likely going to release next year, which will probably go back to, in a way, sort of my legacy, which is looking at masks, because I'm just fascinated by masks. Certainly when I started off, I had this career which I was working in boardrooms and having to put on my mask to be professional and act a certain way. And then come weekend, I'd have my artist mask on, and then I'd come home and have my, husband mask on and my father mask on with my kids. And, I often just think we look out of these two things and we can project how we want to look and how we act. If you or I met the queen or the king, we would act a certain way. If we went on a date, would not that the wives would care for this, but you'd act a certain way. If you went on a job interview, you would act a certain way. And so I like the idea of that we all have this notion of masks, and particularly with politicians. I mean, they're beauts at masking the truth. You can only see how wonderful the Conservative Party are at at telling us one thing and doing something completely different behind our backs. And I just think it's a relevant thing, particularly on social media, where we've got this idea of creating this sort of avatar or persona of who we want to be online, and in reality is probably more mundane than what we let out to be. So I think that's something I'm going to continue to explore. And then politically, I still very much want to kind of explore this idea of happy propaganda, because we've all been lied to. We're constantly getting, misinformation that is altering the facts. I mean, you only have to look at what's happening in Russia and around the world, but, it's here as well. And so this idea of, trying to educate people to the poisonous of or how venomous propaganda is. But, what particularly as I think what I'm interested in is if you look over the last sort of 10 years, particularly after Brexit, how divisive that strategy or that campaign was, and how very much, there's this us and them culture. Yeah. So, had you voted either way from Brexit, it kind of divides people. I mean, people were, as were unfriending their own family and friends based on their sort of ideology of that vote. And you see it more and more now that there's this very much this sort of us and them culture that we're becoming further and further apart. So I still very much want to look at this idea of how propaganda could actually bring us together, not tear us apart.
Yeah. Nice.
So that's why I think that will be my dying legacy to create happy propaganda. But I guess in many ways it's always been there. The Rich Enough to Be Batman, this Oblivious, all of them are happy propaganda. Like Orwell said, all art is propaganda. I'm just conscious of it. That's all.
And just before we do finish, you mentioned earlier about your gallery. Tell us a little bit about that, Heath.
So 3 years ago, I moved into this warehouse. And then during COVID, I quickly realized having a warehouse, having this sort of bohemian lifestyle is great for Instagram photos. But the reality is fucking cold. You just can't heap those spaces up. And especially if you're, you know, screen printing, nothing ever dries.
Yeah.
So I used to pass this, what was a kind of a derelict hairdresser's every day. And during COVID, I thought, you know what, I can't deal with being cold again. So I'm gonna try and make an offer and see if I can get, because I knew during COVID, no one was taking occupancy on retail store simply because they were going to the wayside.
Exactly.
So I made a cheeky offer on this old hairdresser's salon, and which is split level. And I got it and turned it into a gallery, or at least I turned it into a working studio. And then the upstairs where you enter the studio from is just got this, I guess it's like a 20 by 20 sort of, or maybe less, 15 by 15 foot sort of room. And I just didn't want to be working in a fishbowl. So I decided I'd turn it into a gallery. And it was helpful to begin with because I just had it where I could put my own work on the walls and photograph it. And as you know, on Instagram, you don't know if something's this big or that big. You just put everything in little square tiles. But having an actual wall to photograph things on, or having a gallery, gave, I guess, my work some scale and proportion. And then last year, I wanted to apply for Own Art, and I contacted them and asked them if it was possible. And then they just said, you know, I had to be a gallery. And I said, well, I am. And they said, who do you represent? And I said, myself. And they said, well, that's not a gallery. And I went, really?
That's a shop, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. So eventually I just said, all right, I'm going to turn it into a gallery. And I just invited close friends who I've been working with over the years. And then the idea was sort of, I started last year in summer, and I think I'm now on my third kind of rip down and that. And I just thought it's quite fun actually having it. But as I say, it's also quite costly to keep doing it. But yeah, so I have to get you to come up, Gary, and bring your stuff up.
Definitely. And I presume, well, I know, you got your Own Art affiliation, if you like.
Yeah, that all came through early this year. So, I mean, the lovely thing about it is it just allows people to walk in off the street and, you know, purchase things that, you know, that were otherwise inaccessible. I mean, you know, and I know that art is tenuous and it takes time to make. And so when you're asking for something like £1,000 or more for something, you know, very few people go around throwing that sort of money on the table. So Own Art was this great scheme, which I've seen lots of other galleries and artists be involved in, where it just allows you to split payment over 10 months. So if it's £1,000, it means you're just paying, you know, £100 every month for 10 months. So it's,
and there is no fee for the buyer.
No,
on top
I mean,
of
there's a fee as a gallery,
yeah.
But it's worth, you know, putting that, because it just allows people to, you know, purchase art, and that's what it's about, owning art.
Because as you say, if you want to buy an artwork for £1,000, you make 10 installments of 100. There's no interest on top of that.
No
hidden fees.
No.
It is what it is.
Yeah, which is great. You know, it's great for the punter. So that's why I wanted to bring it on. Even though, you know, like even with the pieces that I've got with the Oblivious, you know, they're $250 for the print, $350 framed. It's still a big chunk of money. But if you tell someone it's £35 a month, then all of a sudden it becomes, you know, oh, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, good. Good stuff. All right, then, mate. Well, we're up to today.
Kept it under an hour this time.
Exactly. Everything on my list that I did write down, although we mentioned it when we were speaking before this podcast, we've spoke about. So, Heath, all the very best, mate. It's and I'll pop up as soon as I'm able.
Yeah, look forward to it. I'm glad the family's well, buddy.
Great to see you. See you later.
Yeah, likewise. See you, buddy. Ciao. Bye.
Ciao. Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. It's a podcast that's produced with the help of the listener. And if you like what you've heard and you think you might be able to give a little support, there's two ways in which you can do it. If you go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile, you'll find a Linktree drop-down box. And in that box, you'll find two links. One is called Buy Us a Coffee, and it's pretty much that. You can make a one-off payment, the price of a cup of coffee. Or, if you're able and want to do it more long-term, you can become a Ministry of Arts Patreon, where you can sign up to support us on a monthly basis. And 100% of your support goes back into the podcast. And if you're not able to do that, that's absolutely fine. This content is free for everyone. But we would urge you to follow us on your socials and show us a bit of love that way. Either way, thanks for listening and see you next time. Ta-da.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.